This podcast contains information, theories, and speculation based on the A Song of Ice and Fire novels by George R.R. Martin. It can and will spoil future episodes of the HBO television series Game of Thrones. This is your one and only spoiler warning. If you're looking for our non-spoiler podcast on Game of Thrones, please look in our feed archives for our Sunday night instant take and Tuesday afternoon full podcasts, or go to baldmove.com for our entire catalog. Hey, it's Friday, which means it's time for another spoiler edition of our Game of Thrones podcast. Of course, we're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones, and we're on Bald Move. Branding, blah, blah, blah. I'm your host, Aaron.
I'm Jim.
And that's what happens when I have to introduce a podcast. So we got a lot to talk about. I'm starting to find a new post season 5 format where we do corrections and then kind of like some observations that I made and then and then emails that fit in with that and then just random stuff. So first up first, corrections. There's a corrections thread on the forums that gets made each week, which is I find helpful. First up is Broom Person. Says Willis, this is for last, you know, so this is for the episode before because it's from the last spoiler edition. Because Willis, who we see in a flashback, actually has the scar in which modern day Hodor also has. If you'll recall, I went on a big theory about how there could be some physical trauma and the whole Mr. Tan and
right
damage to the Broca area of his brain. And I did look and found a high res screen capture, and it is it does appear to be that the young Hodor slash Willis has an identical scar pattern that the Elder Hodor has.
Well, there was that theory.
I know. That's a theory that died particularly hard for me because it seemed like very elegant and deliberate and would explain so many things. Mm-hmm. But shit, maybe not. But there's more about the Hodor Willis later. He says also, Aaron, you said something that connected Jon, Dany, and Tyrion. Something that connected them all was that they all killed someone they loved. Well, Jon does not actually kill Ygritte in the books of the show. In the book, she shot off Paige, and Jon finds her. In the show, of course, Ollie kills her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know whether this got lost in a translation of the person's email, but they mentioned that they parenthetically said Jon, while he didn't kill, he feels personally responsible, or responsible in some level for her death.
Okay,
that is a pretty big quibble with that, you know, thing that unifies them all together. Mm-hmm. They still got the whole mother died in childbirth, if the theories are correct, but that one is a little bit shakier than others. Zania says, you mentioned the Blackfyres having dragons offhandedly in your description of the Blackfyre Rebellion, which is where one of the Targaryens lost her mind and legitimized all of his bastards.
Yep.
The dragons were all dead by the time of that civil war. Aeron might have been confused with the realm's previous civil war before that one, the Dance of the Dragons, that took place a few generations prior. It was that war that wiped out most of the dragons. That's correct. The Blackfyre Rebellion happened roughly about 100 years before the show, maybe a little bit before then. So by that time, the dragons had all died out.
I have a question for
you.
Yes. Okay, first of all, pretty easy to get confused on which war is which, I think.
And I'm not, not an expert at the, because I just read The Hedge Knight, which starts to touch on some of the players, like some of the mm-hmm. that happens kind of immediately after, and you meet some of the big players that are from the surviving,
right,
you know, of the Great Bastards. But I've read a lot of the World of Ice and Fire, which is the big leather-bound compendium. But I don't set myself up to be an expert at a Game of Thrones / A Song of Ice and Fire events.
Right.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Second, is there some kind of established like calendar? Can you say for sure like what year something took
yes.
place in, or is it more like here's where we are right now and we relate everything to that?
No, the way they do it is kind of like in Star Wars, you've got before Yavin and after Yavin to kind of center
okay.
yourself. They talk about BC before the Conquering and AC after the Conquering.
What so is the Conquering?
Conquering is when the Targaryens came across from Old Valyria and whipped everybody's ass in Westeros with
okay.
the dragons. And that happened roughly three. We're in 298 to 299 AC at the moment.
Okay.
So it's approximately 300 years after they landed on Westeros and destroyed the Seven Kingdoms.
Does anybody talk about, like, when maybe the last winter was in rough year terms? Like, BC? I assume it's BC, yes?
I mean, I've got some rough estimates, like 3,000 to 8,000 years ago.
But, wow.
But that's,
okay.
That's when, like, so you're talking about the Age of Heroes, which is where, like, Bran the Builder, who is an old Stark, mm-hmm. Supposedly built both the Wall and Winterfell. And, you know, building the Wall seems like that's the last time the winter actually fully came. But mm-hmm. the way, like, old Nan talks about it, it's like maybe the last really bad winter is in recent living memory. But on the other hand, like, we do know that not every winter that comes is a magical winter. Sometimes
right.
they just come, they last for several years, and that sucks. Like, right at the time of the books, you've had an unusually long and prosperous spring. Like, none of the Stark children were ever alive at the time of the last winter.
Okay.
So it's like you got winter with a capital W, and then the winters just come as a result of the seasons.
Sure.
Whatever fucked up seasons that, you know.
There doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to the season.
I mean, there's a lot of people that have tried to come up with some kind of solar mechanics
yeah,
that would make
yeah.
it would work, like some kind of periodic orbiting multiple stars or some kind of really weird elliptical orbit. Or
okay. It sounds like it's futile effort.
It does.
Like, there isn't. It's just
yeah.
magic. It's just
And it seems like there's
random.
Some stuff from the So Spake Martin archive where he says it's magical. Like
okay.
It's not. But on the other hand, there are, even though it is a mystical phenomenon, there are real world signs that it's happening, because the maesters
sure,
at
yeah.
the Citadel have success in predicting when this is the last harvest, and they send the white ravens, let everybody know that winter is actually coming.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So yeah, it confounds your efforts, but there's enough there that you kind of want to try.
Sure.
Trelew from Austin, Texas said, I could be wrong, but I believe John actually would be higher than Danny in the list of secession, assuming that there is something proving his legitimacy. I believe the king has children. They come before their siblings, which is why Robert's children, were they indeed Robert's children, came before Stannis. In this situation, Dany equals Stannis, dead Aegon equals dead Joffrey, and Jon equals Tommen. So yeah, that's
okay.
I need to remember that core principle, is the eldest male's eldest children would come before that guy's brothers, and
yeah.
certainly sisters, because Westeros be sexist, yo. Jasmine in Seattle, I think, is Ajaz. It's been a long time since I read Dance with Dragons, but when I read it, I remember thinking it was Mance and the Wildling girls that were doing all the cloak and dagger killing at Winterfell. Taking issue with my assertion that Theon is the quote-unquote ghost of Winterfell that does all the killing.
Right.
My bad, because there are lots of competing theories about who the Ghost of Winterfell is. And
that's
just yours. Well, I mean, I assumed that that was the most popular one, but then I did. Steph said, I think the most widely accepted Ghost of Winterfell theory is that Harwin, the son of Hulin, which is a member of Ned's household guard, who also was associated with the Brotherhood Without Banners with Arya and a Storm of Swords, is believed to be the Ghost of Winterfell and a possible agent for Lady Stoneheart, which is goes into Grand Northern conspiracy stuff.
Nicknamed Howlin' Hollin' Hoolin.
Hollin' Hoolin?
Howlin'. He got the Howlin' Mad moniker in there, and now nobody can pronounce his name.
In the Stark's Kennel, it's fun fact that Hoolin, in fact, let the dogs out.
Jesus.
it's the gorilla dicks and the dad jokes that people come to the podcast for. So... I feel like the Theon being the Ghost of Winterfell is the coolest one, and also it neatly explains all of his psychotic breaks and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's people in the books like Mance and his spear wives claim to have done some of the killings, but not all of them. I don't know. It's all in the what you want to believe. But yeah, I didn't really give. In fact, I'm thinking maybe I should actually come up with a Ghost of Winterfell theory cast where I spend 15, 20 minutes to go through all the quotes to support all the different theories.
Yeah, maybe if they touch on that in the shows at all.
I feel like that we are headed for some kind of Ghost of Winterfell plot. Although maybe, I don't know, maybe they'll just, the Boltons will just get their butts kicked because Roose is already dead. That doesn't happen in the books. I don't know. Let's see. Hef was amused by my faux pas saying that Ned's father and eldest brother Brandon and Rickon went to the Mad King to demand justice. I think you meant to say his brother Brandon and his father Rickard, but as above, it could read as though Ned's the product of incest, and made me laugh harder at work than I had any real right to. Well, you're welcome for that.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. That's funny to a lot of people, but if you're gonna write in with a name correction, just. We know. Everyone knows.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it could be Aaron just fucking up with his fat tongue, or it could be that he legitimately got Rickon and Rickard confused. So, like I said, it's a correction. I don't mind issuing it. The coolest theory that I became aware of after this episode is called Bran the Originator.
Okay.
So we talked about how we're not so sure about the idea of Bran being involved in time travel.
Right.
Apparently, with this Tower of Joy thing and Ned hearing Bran, a lot of people have dusted off some other things from the books, or been hunting for things in the books. For example, when Jon, back in the very first book, Game of Thrones, when he finds Ghost away from the other direwolves, if you recall, there was 5 regular-colored direwolves, sort of 5 natural-born Stark children, and then Jon Snow found the runt of the litter, who was the albino direwolf Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
He was off a ways, and in the books it's described, John like cocks his head to one side and is like, do you guys hear that? And the other Stark children are like, nah, it's just the wind. And then John is led by this sound over to the thicket or grove or whatever where Ghost is at. Some people are starting to say, since the three-eyed raven said, you know, when Bran questioned whether his father heard him, and I was like, well, maybe he heard you, maybe he heard the wind. People are starting to wonder if Bran wasn't influencing other events in the books and causing them in like a circular paradox. For example, him going back and seeing the scene, he could have said something that Jon heard that led him to the direwolf Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty cool. There's other add-on theories where perhaps Bran says something to Hodor that causes him to lose his mind. So Bran is actually the cause of Hodor's brain damage.
Hmm. Okay.
And then there's an extreme form of the theory, which is essentially the Mad King says that he was listening to whispers, and that's one of the things that drove him insane, and that Bran trying to change the past by reasoning with the Mad King, who started off as a fairly decent ruler by Westerosi King standards, eventually drove him crazy and led to his madness.
Hmm.
So it's like one of those things where you can't really change the past, no matter how hard you try. But if you can't change the past, does that mean that you are the one that caused it as well?
Maybe.
I mean, that's a funny kind of weird cosmic thing. That's like, that's basic time travel sci-fi 101. I don't know that I mind that kind of causality loop being inserted into Game of Thrones. Like something that Bran decides to try. And there's also people, that's a great exception. They were kind of pissed at this assertion that Bran's doing any kind of time travel. And they're like, he's just viewing the past. He's not going actually back in the past. But my thought is, okay, but if Eddard Stark actually heard Bran call out father, that means that he did transmit information into the past,
mm-hmm.
which means that's the definition of time travel.
Unless he's not actually in the past, he's seeing a vision that he can interact with that is outside of the time stream, right? Like a representation of the past, but not the past itself.
Yeah, so this is very much kind of a developing theory, and it's all about if. Right. If people are actually hearing him and not the wind. But there's other instances in the books where we see from Bran's point of view that he's actually watching like Theon Reek, I guess, at this point, why the Boltons have control of Winterfell, and Theon is in the Weirwood Grove that's in Winterfell.
Mm-hmm.
Theon hears him, or thinks he hears him. I think there's another instance in the books where someone hears Bran while he's warging into the trees and whatnot. There's some legs to this theory. It's all going to be down to if people actually can hear him and if that actually influences the past.
Right. Because
then you got time travel, like it
sure.
or not.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of...
Season 7 is going to be big... all about Valyrian DeLoreans. They're not stainless steel. They're Valyrian steel DeLoreans.
So it opens a big can of worms, which I'm afraid of. Like... I don't know how long they've been sitting there. I don't know if they're good or bad, but yeah. Once you open that can, there's no going back. But at the same time, I do like the kind of breadcrumbs that he's dropping, if that is, in fact, what he's doing.
Yeah, if he puts back the... It's one of those things where if he's talking about the wind whispering being Bran back in book
right.
one,
right.
fuck you, George Martin.
That's awesome.
And I'm saying that in like the Matthew McConaughey True Detective sense of just uh-huh. like total respect. Like that is pretty intense.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's develop a little bit about this stuff with Hodor and Bran. MB wrote.
Or maybe George Martin
wrote.
Is going back in time and inserting things into his own book after the fact.
Prove him wrong.
Right?
Prove him wrong, people. MB writes, I'm chiming in at the thought about the Hodor-Bran relationship in the Game of Thrones. Parenthetically, as a show-only watcher who's just started listening into the spoiler cast since Jim came on to represent my side of the convo. And thinking about Hodor's former life as Willis, most people seem to focus on implications for Bran's power, that he can warg into a person who might have stronger mental acuity and capacity than we had thought. I think we should also be dealing with how cruel it is for Bran to bodily manipulate Hodor if he's actually a cognizant man trapped inside his own mind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even if he's, you know, not... a fully functional mental adult that's still like, you know, I don't think a person with the diminished mental capacities is just like free pass to mentally hijack my shit. But anyway, let's go with this. Hodor's reaction to waking up after Bran had used him to snap Locke's neck in season 4, episode 5 gave me the sense that Hodor is unsettled by what he'd been made to do.
Yeah.
I think we're supposed to realize how much it damages Willis to have his agency or whatever it is taken from him when Bran wargs in. Hodor/Willis is a gentle giant, and here Bran controls him to nearly take someone's head off with his bare hands. How would any of us react if we woke up with a broken body in our hands and no memory of how it got there? Not great, Bob. This makes me think less kindly of Bran. I thought this back in season 4, but we're seeing Willis before he became Hodor. I think even stronger that we're meant to see Bran as at least a little selfish, elitist, and irresponsible with other people. I'm going to blow your mind here, MB. There's a passage in Dance of Dragons, is the third Bran chapter, where he describes when he wargs into Hodor, that Hodor actually has like a little place inside his brain that he retreats to. Quote, like a dog who has had all the fight whipped out of him, Hodor would curl up and hide whenever Bran reached out for him. His hiding place was somewhere deep within him, a pit where not even Bran could touch him. Implying that no, Hodor does not like this. This is very much an assault of his volition, and that Bran knows it and does it anyway.
Right. Bastard.
Well, it's almost like you give an 8-year-old this godlike power with no training and no supervision, and it's like it's entirely possible that Bran turns out to be, if not evil, like a Dr. Manhattan character who just doesn't see the normal people the way that he like loses kind of a touch to humanity, which also ties into some things that Childhood of Forest is telling, like Mira. Like, Bran's going to need you. Why? As a connection to his humanity, as a, you know, person that can carry him after he uses up Hodor, who knows? But I thought that's interesting.
Yeah, and I actually can't help but draw a parallel in my mind to Theon / Reek. I wonder if he could maybe do the same thing to Theon, and he kind of goes into this very small Reek sort of place in his head.
Sure.
I don't know. There's no supporting evidence that that's going to happen. It's just a parallel.
Anthony B. says, is it just me or does anybody think that Bran seeing his father lying about the Tower of Joy is foreshadowing of the fact that his father has kept even bigger secrets and lies, such as Jon Snow being a Targaryen and his real parents being Lyanna and Rhaegar?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, I mean,
like, I can't imagine that theory doesn't come true.
And that's the thing. Like, you see the show trying to lay as many tracks as they can as rapidly as possible.
Right.
And I think that as each of those puzzle pieces snap in, it's looking more and more likely that that's the case. But you're right. I think the part we're supposed to take away as a show watcher is, oh, shit. You know, Ned's not quite as honorable as we thought, and he's not above stretching the truth to shield people from the consequences of their actions.
Mm-hmm.
Also, something I want to point out is Varys, his little birds. In the show, he says, children are blameless, I'd never hurt them. And, you know, he likes to make people happy. In the books, Varys tears out the tongues of these children to make it impossible for them to betray him.
How do they whisper?
They don't whisper. I guess that he makes sure they're literate so they can read secrets and notes and stuff, and they write
and
things.
Write to him.
But yeah, he doesn't want them to be able to betray him or make a sound, so he rips their tongues out. Is that just because it seems like they sometimes, like Cersei in the book, she's very one dimensionally kind of evil and very, I mean, she's still a pitiable character, but it's very easy to hate her and dismiss her as a three dimensional character. In the show, they keep giving her things to kind of humanize her. Do you think that, like, Martin doesn't give a shit whether you root for Varys or want to see him succeed? He just is this pragmatic kind of thing. Whereas in the show, they want us to identify and kind of care about Tyrion and see him as a good guy.
Yeah, I think so.
Or do you think that rippings of tongues are things to come? Like, oh, you're going to take sweets from this fucker? Well, I'm going to come back to King's Landing and lay down the law. Give me your tongues.
So how does... I'm not sure how that works. So he rips out the tongues so they can't communicate with anyone else, but they can write to him, so why couldn't they write down their shit to someone else?
Well, you know, that's where my theory kind of breaks down.
Okay. But is there just an assumption that these beggar kids wouldn't be able to write, and so nobody ever asked them to write?
Probably. Yeah. Okay. I mean, you see a beggar kid, you already dismiss it. You see a mute beggar kid, and it's like, oh, fuck. So,
right.
I mean, but I'm just saying that Varys, his justification for doing it is that he couldn't take the risk of being betrayed or having them speak. So,
okay. Being betrayed through words. He's not concerned about writing.
Right. Or, I mean, is it possible to teach someone to read but not write?
But what good would that be to him?
I don't think it is, because you can just copy the things that you've seen. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, if you can read, but yeah, you're right, because then there's no way to get him out.
Yeah. How do they communicate with you?
His private sign language.
Right. If he was telepathic or something, maybe that'd be good, but...
Anyway, I thought that was interesting, just the way they're spinning his character a bit.
Yeah.
Greg Von B said, I was rewatching season 2, and I noticed that the Night's Watch discovers a satchel that has the dragonglass daggers. Included is a horn. I'm not a book reader, but is the horn of significance? Is this the horn that you mentioned of significance that can control dragons? Oh boy, there's a lot of horns in the books. this one is...
Surprise, surprise.
Well, so first of all, nobody really knows, because they haven't made anything of that horn. They certainly made a lot of the dragon glass that was inside of it. It could be a hint, because there is this plot in the book that what Mance claims to be doing with his wildling army is searching for the Horn of Joramund, also called the Horn of Winter, which is said to be able to wake giants out of stone. It's also said to be able to destroy the wall with a single blow of its horn. But the details get murky from there because Mance claims to have found it, but he's captured. Melisandre burns the horn with him. Then Toramund, after it's gone, admits or claims to say that we just got this. We got this big horn from the grave of an old northern giant, and Mance was saying that just to kind of like pretend like he has a nuclear bomb that might destroy you as a kind of a piece of leverage, but it was just a fake horn all along.
Okay,
but maybe Toramund doesn't know, or maybe Toramund's lying. But at any rate, so that would mean that the horn that got burnt by Melisandre was a fake. Means the real one's possibly still hanging out there.
Wow.
But it's... And so this could be just a wink to book readers that, hey, look, there's a horn. I mean, doesn't match the description. This horn in the book is, like, massive. It's, like, 8 foot long, like, from some giant extinct ox. I don't know. Maybe it's a giant penis. Who knows? But, yeah, so it's a little murky. Until I see another horn... If I see a horn and it's associated with the Greyjoys and the Iron Islands, I'm going to assume it's the dragon horn that we talked about previously. If I see a horn up north, I'm going to assume it's this other one. But since we haven't seen it thus far, so...
All right.
But there again, I mean, that's another thing where, like, we didn't really see a lot of hints that R plus L equals J. I mean, there was 7 minutes in 50 hours of television.
Right.
So... Whereas it's a lot more, I guess, concrete in the books. So if this was going to be a plot point, it could just not, they're just not going to introduce it until it's time for it to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, the wall falling down is something that a lot of people theorize because for some other things we're about to talk about. Let's just move on. Dominic S. said, the weakest plot for me in this season so far is that Ellaria and the Sand Snake's assassination of Doran and Tristane Martell. Because it's not just weak, it's untenable. According to Wiki of Ice and Fire, the Martells have ruled Dorne from 700 BC when the Princess Nymeria and the Rhoyonars reunited with them and unified Dorne, up to the present day of the books, which is in the year 2000-ish AC. In fact, it's very late 2000, 2098, 2099. This means they've ruled the unified kingdom of Dorne for almost 1,000 years since its inception. Safe to say that they're at least...
Wait, 2,098 or 298?
298. Did I say 2098?
Okay. You said, yeah, 2,098.
Ah, fuck.
Okay.
Because I was trying not to say 2098, because that's what my brain was coming up. So I said 2098.
You said it. Yep.
Perfect. Glad you didn't say 2098. Stupid brain. So, safe to say they're at least as much of a brand name in Dorne as the Starks are in the North. I think we're already being lenient by writing off the guards standing idly by while their legitimate prince and rulers murdered in cold blood in front of his eyes. We're chalking that up to his unpopularity. Fine. It's a long shot, but I suppose it's possible that as a popular uprising led by Ellaria and the Sand Snakes could galvanize enough support among the common folk to sweep and wipe out the Martells in a sudden coup. But such a popular uprising can't last in principle. As with every other great house in Westeros, House Martell is held up by the support of their vassals. I don't see how all the houses could sit idly by and let a coup led by bastard children of the ruling dynasty take power. First off, their duty to their liege lord would demand that they exact justice against Ellaria for his murder. Even if we assume that Doran is so unpopular with his own vassals that they would welcome the downfall of the entire Martell dynasty, there's another problem for Ellaria and the Sand Snakes. Their only legitimacy lies in being unlegitimized bastards of the former ruling house, which doesn't seem to count for that much in Westeros. And by the way, if they do allow unlegitimized bastards to seize power with impunity, this undermines their very own legitimacy. This means that Ellaria and the Sand Snakes are going to face a large army of Dornishmen. It'll either be a combined force of loyal vassals who are going after them for their open and blatant treason, or an army of an ambitious vassal who kills them to increase their own legitimacy in a bid for the Dornish crown. The only way to protect themselves from the situation is finding another Martell and using him or her as a puppet. My prediction of hope is that Arianne Martell makes an appearance after all, as first as a pawn of Ellaria and the Sand Snakes, and then eventually exacting revenge against them for the murder of her father and brother in a beautifully ironic fashion. Having heard that, Jim, I was ready to just dismiss this entire email until he made the point about the noblemen of Dorne and how if they go along with this, then what's to stop any upstart in their own house to be like, oh, fuck, we're just killing lords. I'm, you know, you're an unlegitimized bastard and I'm running things now.
Right, right. Yeah, I think there's some solid reasoning in there, assuming, you know, the politics are how he lays them out, which I'll trust that they are. I don't think that they're going to have an easy time of it. Like, yeah. They've done this thing, killing Doran. I don't know that they fully thought through the consequences of it.
Right.
And I hope that there are some consequences, whether they're able to overcome them or not. I hope there's something, because it doesn't seem like you can just kill a prince and get away with it.
Well, and, you know, to Dominic's point here, it's like, it's possible that they do this anyway in the show because it's just not nearly as complex politically. Like, this is the kind of shit that Martin sweats in the books, but
that's
the
true.
Show tends to streamline in favor for the highlight stuff, which they have to do. I mean, there's no way you can adapt, like, especially in the later books, there's just no fucking way. Like, Game of Thrones starts off yay thick, and the next one is yay. I mean, it right. just keeps getting to Dance of Dragons and Feast for Crows is like together, which is essentially a single narrative, is like three times as thick as the first one. Like okay. it's a story that just keeps on getting larger and larger, and at a time where even people reading the books, I think, are surprised that Martin's not kind of narrowing down, like. You know, there's all these new characters and plots and situations. So I think you might, Dominic, be setting yourself up for disappointment. I agree with kind of like the QED nature of your analysis of the political situation, but...
Yeah, the show seems to take a very narrow view of Dorne. Like,
yeah.
I've only recall ever seeing this one ruler.
Yeah. And it could be that this is a campaign against all the noble in the show, nobility in the show. That this is a popular uprising, in which case, you know, Dorne as far as a principality is fucked, and it's never going to be the same. And also, winter's coming, so who cares?
I'm going to feel extra ripped off if that's the case. Like, suddenly it's just like, oh yeah, and all of the other nobles were killed in the land by the uprising too.
But that's what happened in France. That's literally what happened in France.
Right, but if I were telling the story of the French Revolution, I would absolutely not just focus on this one guy in this one place and then after the fact say, oh yeah, everybody else got killed too.
Mm.
I would show the popular uprising. I would have some kind of lead up, some foreshadowing to show, tell me, this is not a problem just in this one location. And I wouldn't paint Dorne as a single location, like, as just this unified thing under
Dorne.
But
if you're telling the story from the point of, like, you know, the French nobility, and you've got, like, Marie Antoinette's, like, let them eat cake, which I know is not exactly a nuanced analysis of her statement, but I could see that being a fact. It's kind of like no one really saw the sparrows coming until they were setting up shop.
Uh-huh.
You know, but when you think about it, it's like, oh, well, I guess that's a logical outcome for a war-ravaged kingdom where all the small folk are getting their houses burnt and their crops burnt, and there's a lot of people wandering the roads poor and sick, and there's these religious revivals. Like, okay, now that I know the whole situation, it kind of makes sense why they're there.
A little weird to me, like, just having...
I don't want to be in a position of defending what they're doing in Dorne, because I think it's a hot mess, but my thing is, I thought it was kind of a hot mess in the books, too.
Okay. Well, I just don't like how, you know, it's been portrayed as Alara and her daughters or whatever are just kind of doing a thing here, and they have some nebulous support from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
But is it just in that city? Like,
right.
I just don't feel like, oh yeah, and there's another group of Sand Snake likes in this other area,
and
killing
the fact
nobles
that
there.
They had the entire household guard cool with it. I mean, that didn't sit well with me either.
It's just such a big project.
It is.
I would like to see some of the infrastructure, some of the logistics there.
Yeah. But like I said, I struggle to say that it's worse than what goes on in the books.
Right.
It's certainly less complicated and it's certainly less nuanced, but
yeah,
you know, I wasn't a huge fan. Like I said, I wanted to be a huge fan of Dorne And I kind of was like, okay, Doran, the Prince Doran, Fire and Blood. All right, let's see how your grand scheme works out. And then his son got set on fire and by a dragon, and it's kind of wah wah.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel Shogun into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Matt S. said, can you explain how Bran sees sees the Winterfell courtyard? Wait a second. I think he's actually asking, how can Bran see down into Dorne? Like, he buys the fact that Bran can see where Weirwoods can see, but he doesn't. He's like, can he just see anywhere? And in the books, they go into this, and I'm not sure if they're going to explain it in the show as well, but one of the lessons that the Three-Eyed Raven teaches Bran is that, you know, the Children of the Forest carved the faces on the Weirwoods as part of their spiritual awakening, and those eyes are the first eyes that a green seer learns to master, because they're the easiest, they have the most direct connection. Mm-hmm. But in time, as your strength and skill increase, you can start using mini eyes. Like, you know, people take it for granted that Three-Eyed Raven can see through ravens, and maybe he can see through every living thing. Mm-hmm. But no, it's not just the Weirwoods, because if that's the case, you'd be blind, completely blind down south, because one of the things that the Andals did when they invaded and brought in the Faith of the Seven is they started cutting down all those troublesome Weirwood forests that people were worshipping. So it's very rare to see them south of the Neck, which is kind of like the middle of the peanut that is Westeros. Let's see. Evan G says, you're discussing the fairy tale incest ending with Jon Snow and Daenerys ruling together as king and queen when a Song of Ice and Fire comes to an end. Do you think that Daenerys will rule as queen and then make Jon Snow the Warden of the North, essentially bringing the entire Westeros under the rule of one family, i.e. the Targaryens, while the Targaryens continue their cousin-fucking traditions? Continuing their cousin-fucking traditions would make sense. I'm wondering if the entire book series is supposed to come full circle, starting with the Targaryen rule coming to an end, the whole of Westeros in chaos, and ending with magic and dragons returning with the Targaryens ruling once more.
Yeah, maybe.
If I was going to go the full fairy tale incest ending, I think, and keeping in mind this version of A Song and Ice of Ice and Fire, it makes sense to have Dany being the queen of the South and then Jon returning to the Stark way of having being the king in the North. But it's a joint rule because they would be married and in love and making incest babies. But I always thought that would be kind of, that would also be a little duality. You have this king, this wintry king of the North. You got this summery, fiery queen of the South. I mean, that makes sense. It's a little saccharine, but it does make sense.
Okay.
John being the warden, I mean, what the fuck does that even mean? He'd be the king consort.
Yeah.
And also the warden of the North. I guess that makes as much sense as anything.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still on board with maybe Jon Snow being both fire and ice. So maybe he ends up, and maybe that's why they started off so prominently on Ned and stuff. But who knows? Who knows?
Jim from Pasadena has a book complaint, which was echoed several places on the internet, and I got a couple in my email bag. So they just crap all over the classic scene where Arthur Dayne, the knight who knighted Jaime, fights with Dawn, the Sword of the Morning, or was that all bullshit in the books? And he actually fought with two swords. What? I can accept that Howland Reed acted dishonorably and Ned has been covering up for him all these years, just adding to things that Ned has been covering up, which is actually a nice wrinkle to the story. But screwing with the details of the books like this becomes problematic when they don't have the story of the book to explain the changes they're making. Are they artistic license or something that we have been misled about in the story as readers and will eventually be told the truth about in the book? He also has a problem with the actual wording because...
I have no idea what he's talking about. What?
Okay, so... I'm sorry, I should have explained all this. In the books, it's a 3-on-7 battle. There's 3 Kingsguard versus 7
There's only 2 in the show.
Yeah, and I think that it's as simple as, like, the choreography is easier. Like, that's a simple solution for why we'd limit it. There's also the verbiage that Ned and the Kingsguard bandy back and forth is similar to in the show, but it's not nearly as cool/elegant. And, you know, that's been brought up before. Like, I know that people lost their mind when Littlefinger threw his Eliza through the moon door. Mm-hmm. And in the books, he says, "You silly woman, I've only loved one woman all my life." And he says, "Only cat," and throws her out the door. Where in the show, he says, "Your sister." And people right. lost their shit because that's – your sister is not as cool as only cat, I guess. But
okay.
In that instance, you have to balance the needs of the people who, you know, watching a show and might not know that Catelyn Stark is her sister. That's not at the tip of their brain, the tip of their tongues. Whereas they would recognize the fact that I don't know. I don't understand. It's essentially, and if you think this is all bullshit, I beg to differ. Because let's say there's a Star Wars novels series where Darth Vader says to Luke Skywalker, "Luke, I am your father," and everyone's like, "Oh, that's super badass." And in the movies, he says, "Luke, I'm your dad." I'm your daddy. That's not as badass. It's just not. It's objectively not. So people get upset when, like, you've got this really artful phrase. Why the fuck did you? It's not any longer. It's not any shorter. It makes it's identical right. in meaning. Why did you fuck with it?
Right. To me, like, changing it to your sister is not like, I'm changing not saying it to that, your but, dad. But it's not, like, objectively stupid.
But I do agree, and when our next Audible ad comes up, I'm going to take the clip from this actual scene and probably play it unless something better comes up.
So is his problem that they say different things?
Well, there's
that
different
there are
number of kings.
So
it's just the fact that they're changing things for no apparent good reason, and now that they don't have the books to guide them, it's making him as a book reader feel less sure that they're not fucking this up.
Are you sure that's not what they're intending to do?
That's
to confuse you as a book reader. Like, who gives a fuck? It's 2 or 3, nobody cares. Just like, and at this point, we are so far afoul of the books as far as like actual substantial plot goes.
No, sure.
I don't know why you would take the books as any reasonable expectation in the show.
Well, I mean, that's dumb.
No. To a certain degree, you can use it to say, oh, maybe this will happen this way because in the books it goes this way. But fucking Roose Bolton is dead. Fucking, like, 10 people are dead who aren't
that
dead.
That's what's going to happen in the books. This is being straight. Like, okay.
But
let's
if you
back
assume
up,
that Roose Bolton would be alive at this point, you'd be goddamn wrong.
But what I'm saying,
like,
is, I think what...
The show is a different thing.
Yes, but the logical end of your argument is that anything could happen in a show, and that can't be true. or else.
Right.
I mean, I speaking as a book reader who
that's only the extreme end of that argument. That's not a nuanced approach at all.
I know, but I'm saying in between the you have to follow the book slavishly versus anything right. goes is the great debate about what particularly strikes your ear as wrong. Like
exactly.
Luke, I'm your daddy. Exactly what he says in the movies, but it's not nearly as cool. And like, I think that would be a minor point, but I think most Star Wars fans would agree that ooh, I was really looking forward to that. That gave me chills in the book, and I hear daddy? That doesn't give me chills.
Right, of course not.
So,
but I don't think there's been anything like that that's really stood out, except for maybe the sand snakes.
But you're not
snakes.
A book reader, and that's the thing. Like,
But if Darth Vader had in the movies, and this was canon and the only thing that existed, said, Luke, I'm your daddy, I would be like, what the fuck are you talking about, Mr. Vader?
But this Tower of Joy scene does happen in the books.
Right.
So,
right.
like, we're still, I mean, this is one of the things where it's, in fact, it happened in book one. It's something that Ned flashed back to while he's sitting cooling his heels in the dungeon. I mean, again, yes, there is a gulf between the two different sides of the argument, but I think in the middle, like, I feel like that if I was going to weigh in the Jim of Pasadena, I think he's being a little bit reactionary, but I think it is hard to argue that. And the number of Kingsguard doesn't matter. The number of people in Ned's party doesn't matter. The choreography doesn't matter. But the verbiage was cooler. And that's the kind of stuff the book readers are like, why would they change it? There was no reason to change it.
Sure.
Not even like getting people confused, because it's essentially a more artful way to say, like, well, your dude's dead. Well, fuck, if I'd been there, it'd been a whole other story, bro. I mean,
yeah,
that would also be a perfectly valid way to translate Ned and Sir Arthur Dayne's dialogue, but people would be super pissed about that.
Right. I mean, I think the chasm is book first versus show first.
Like, sure.
Whatever. Like, it, as long as it isn't objectively stupid, like, Luke, I'm your daddy.
And this scene wasn't.
Then it doesn't matter to me. Like, yeah. If it could be cooler, yeah, everything could be cooler. Like, what do you want?
Well,
I'm a show first.
To me, the only reason you make things less cool is to condense things and save on budget.
Okay.
If you're making it less cool just because, I do scratch my head.
Maybe they thought they were making it more cool.
And the Double D's wrote this episode, so
right.
I hate to say this, but not a big fan of your fart, and not a big fan of your editorializing Sir Arthur Dayne.
Okay.
Let's move on to Sean S. Says, you're going to have to put on a bit of tinfoil hat for this one.
So boy.
I got mine on. On second view, I noticed something with the Cersei scenes and Arya's montage. They have a lot of focus on the mount in this episode, a la bad fart joke at the small council table and the scared little birds. We also have mention of tribal combat by Cersei and Jaime's comment of that's a trial I'd like to see. Flash to Arya and with her waif talking about the hound and admission by Arya that she only left him to die, not that he died outright. Now, I know it's too early to call Clegane Bowl, seeing as how we haven't seen the Gravedigger in his quiet isle yet, but may it be safe to assume you had me at it's never too early to call Clegane Bowl. It's going to happen. All the doubters are fucking wrong. It's going to happen. There's no way they spent that much time talking about the fucking hound and whether he's alive or dead, and Cersei saying, oh, I want to try about combat, and Jaime's like, oh, that's something I'd want to. No fucking way Clegane Bowl's not going to happen.
You're right. Bastard Bowl, Clegane Bowl, they're all happening.
I feel like we need, because there's something in, like we need some kind of sound drop when we do the Clegane Bowl. You know?
We can make one. Like, just like get some a big echoey kind of, Clegane.
Yeah, Bowl. Or with some kind of, like, horns going off, and like it's a, you know, like a bass drop.
Okay.
Ooh, yeah, that needs to happen.
We'll do it.
Yeah, we got to mention the fact that there's some serious Clegane Bowl get hype stuff going on. Jason Z adds to it. He said, Arya taking out Jon is a fun theory for the show pod, but I had another hopeful theory that pits Arya against the mountain. I know we're all secretly hoping for the Clegane Bowl, but Arya has a short list in the show, and in both books and her show, the list includes the mountain. Now, remember, the reason that she's going to have to go after Jon is because the Faceless Men would be pissed that he's brought back to life.
Right.
You can say the same fucking thing about the mountain.
Sure.
Which is the cool part of this theory. He continues, training complete, badassery honed. What if Arya set out to take the mountain at a pivotal point in the show? This might mean as part of the trial of combat that's coming, or another situation in which the mountain or Robert Strong is set to conquer something of importance for Cersei. Even better, maybe she takes out Cersei at the same time, a twofer revenge scene. I think the ultimate would be a Clegane Bowl showdown where the Hound finds himself down and out, and Arya, who's been known to struggle with wanting to kill the Hound or not, has a change of heart and saves his life. In this case, saves it by killing the mountain. Everyone wins. Okay. There's some things I like about this. Not sure how I feel about a ninja monkey Arya jumping out of the stands at the trial of combat and killing the mountain to spare the Hound. Like, that seems a little too...
Well...
I don't know.
The mountain is sort of faceless. Let's have Faceless Bowl. That sounds good. Arya is actually the trial by combat.
Sure. Well, that's the thing. Like, here. It can't just be Arya versus the mountain. Because number one, I don't know that I buy that Arya, even with her faceless man powers, can take on the mountain
and Needle.
Not just... in a trial by not like she could absolutely kill the mountain if that was her only task, but to do it in like a
right.
Challenge of the Seven kind of way, which takes us to the next point, which is with Laura McPhee piles on as Clegane Bowl hype theory. I haven't heard anyone take the scenario to its inevitable end yet. I think the Hound will win, you know, assuming all the Clegane Bowl. And finally, even if it is by a technicality, if Franken Mountain loses, then Cersei is condemned. This makes me wonder if she will live to see the next season. I could definitely see this being an episode 9 kind of plot point. I guess if I go this with this prediction, then I probably have to figure that Tommen is toast by then, too, so the Maggie the Frog's prophecy is completely fulfilled, all of her children being killed. Perhaps Tommen tries to interfere in his mother's execution and winds up getting himself killed in the process just before Cersei's executed. What does Jaime do then? If his sister, lover, and all of his children are dead, he could be quite the loose cannon. It also makes it pretty easy for Dany to take the throne, assuming she can never get the hell out of Essos. Also, I bet Arya makes an appearance in Westeros by then. She might even beat the Sparrows to killing Cersei.
Wow.
So, the thing is, if you believe in the Clegane Bowl, you're obviously wanting the Hound, the living Hound, to beat his hated brother, the Mountain.
Of course, yeah.
When, and we already talked about the problems of that theory.
Unless you're a real bastard.
Right. And we already talked about the problems of that theory and your reaction, because like the big problem is if the Hound comes back solely for vengeance, it kind of rolls back his peaceful character development. So it'd have to be something that's like he's kind of wanting it's a mission he's on for the faith, and he realizes the mountain's already dead, and he's bringing his brother like peace, maybe. Okay. But if he wins, then Cersei's doomed, and then what happens?
She gets killed. I can see Cersei getting killed.
But the prophecy is she's killed by the hands of the little brother.
By the hands of the little brother?
Yeah. Like the full prophecy that you didn't see in the show was was that you remember I talked about the Valonqar?
Vaguely.
Yeah. So the witch in the woods says that you, after all your children are dead, you'll be killed at the hands of the Valonqar, which is a High Valyrian word for little brother.
Okay.
Which she Cersei believes is Tyrion, which is why she's desperately trying to find him in the books and have him killed. Right. A lot of people say that a neat fulfillment would be Jaime strangling her. But the other thing is, if the Hound is victorious, maybe he's given the honor. And the Hound is the little brother of... It doesn't say your little brother. It just says the little brother.
Also, it doesn't say that in the show. So who knows if they're even going to go that direction.
No, but
they might have left that out on purpose.
Or they could be saving that flashback for this season, because we flashback for no good reason to see Cersei's original prophecy. They could flashback for the second
half
of it.
Was there a second prophecy?
It's all one. But I'm saying is like just in similar that they split the Tower of Joy reveal into two different episodes, they could just do that with a whole season apart.
I suppose so.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not really fighting for that.
Yeah.
But the Hound could strangle her to death without the prophecy in the show, and it'd still be cool for us book readers, and that's probably... That would also indicate that that's probably how it's going to go down in the books as well.
Also, let's just say this is a crazy old witch in a straw house. We don't know that this prophecy is actually coming true, right?
And that's true
like,
about all the
prophecies. It could just be literally her fear is the point.
And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, the way she's raised her children and so herself is bringing about this shit.
Right. So there's nothing that says Tommen really has to die.
No.
But if you think that the prophecy is going to come true, sure.
Right.
How would he die?
Yeah. And it's the lines blurred because We have prophecies that appear to not be fulfilled and in fact are false. We have prophecies that appear to be true and are fulfilled. We have things that are true after a certain faction. We have real magic powers and we have false magic. I mean, you could do anything. As long as I guess it's cool and it, and people think it makes sense, Martin can probably get away with it. So, but all those things, you're right, are on the table. Let's move on. Oh, there's one last Gregor Clegane Bowl kind of thing. Jonas M. says, what theories do you have around the true makeup of Robert Strong / the Mountain? In the books, I'm pretty sure his skull is sent to Dorne as a trophy. Though in the show, it doesn't address this. I still think it's interesting to ponder whose head could be under that helmet. What if it was Robert Baratheon or Tywin Lannister? Highly unlikely, but I'm pretty sure Qyburn was given the green light on any means necessary to finish his work. Your thoughts. Now, Jim, this isn't a show question, because in a show it's pretty fucking clear that it's just the Mountain's head.
I think so. But or could it be a fake direwolf head under there? Is there any chance that the head is too small to be a real direwolf or the Mountain, and they've had to replace it?
Oh, they had to cut the snout off. That'd be a freak show. That is another popular speculation. You joke, but the fact that it's Ned, or it's Rob's head.
Rob's head?
Yeah.
Oh my god!
Because it's like we know it's cut off and
right. Yeah. Where'd it go?
But they supposedly sent Gregor's skull to the Dornish to pacify them, as like their sister's killer has been brought to justice after a fashion. Now that could be any large dude's head. But there's also a passage in the book where Bran is green seeing and he sees what we later find out to be an allusion to the Mountain. It's this giant figure clad in white enamel, which is the armor of the Kingsguard, and his visor lifts up and just blood, like the Shining style, pours out of this helmet, and it's just a black inky expanse. It's just shooting blood, which some people think that. Because in the show, he's wearing a full face visor. You like can't literally see his face. That he might be headless in the books, which is fucking cool. Yeah. I wish they could have pulled that off in the show.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I don't have it. I've heard theories with Rob, although Rob's head might be accounted for now that I'm thinking of it. I've heard theories that it's Joffrey. They've had a couple theories that it could be Joff's head. It could be some other unrelated. It could be Tywin. Usually those theories are along the lines of, oh man, when he finally reveals who it is, fucking Cersei's going to shit her pants, kind of like schadenfreude of like how she'll feel about that after authorizing all this. But yeah, I don't think it's a true show fact, and it's probably at best is going to be a cool irrelevant detail in the books. So that's all the thoughts I have on it. Hey, I want to take this opportunity to tell you about our club at club.baldmove.com. You go there to tell you all about it, but the upshot is you, for as little as $1 a month, you support Bald Move. You get all the bonus features. We don't have tiers. It's like $5 premium platinum support, $10. And if you want to give us more, bless you. This is blessings of the seven be upon you. But you can squeak by for as little as $12 a year. You get all of our bonus content, including video recordings for podcasts. Now, what's cool about that is if you cannot wait to talk to someone about Game of Thrones, you got no one else in your life, we record the instant take. That's like 5-10 minutes after the episode. That's pretty damn fast. Faster than After the Thrones, Andy and Chris calling you guys out. You can watch us, you know, talk for 20 to 30 minutes about the episode and kind of set up the debate for the following week. It's the fastest way to get our podcast because everything else involves actually recording it and then compressing it and then uploading it and then posting it, and it's just a mess. But you can get it right there and watch our dumb faces record it. There's also a bunch of other stuff. We're going to have a Game of Thrones Telltale video game out. The final chapter of the House Forrester saga is going to be up later this season. We've got a board game Battles of Westeros playthrough that we're going to post later this season. And plus we got special shows and like after hours cocktails and lunches, like all kinds of bonus content for almost nothing. $1 a month. Go to club.baldmove.com if that sounds interesting, and we thank you in advance for your support. Ryan Bennett says, I know a lot of people have already grouped the two prophecies together, but I thought it was strange to hear Melisandre say the prince that was promised instead of Azor Ahai, which is the prophecy in her religion. Your thoughts? So I researched this a bit, and I found an old video from HBO about the religions in Westeros that I think was for season two. I'll link the YouTube on YouTube in the show notes, where Martin himself freely interchanges the prince that was promised with Azor Ahai. And my take on this is, okay, so imagine that, as I've talked about in the previous podcast, that the winter, the big winter, the capital W winter, is a global phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, when people say that the evidence for, like, Noah's flood being true is that, like, every major religion, a lot of peoples, a lot of periods of globes have, like, a flood mythology.
Right.
You know, you could also say that maybe in, like, some place in Africa where we all spawned, there's a big flood, and that's some kind of global memory. It doesn't have to be a religious fact, but and in the same way, like, Jesus is seen differently by, like, a lot of the Abrahamic religions. Like, the Jews see him differently than the Muslims, than the Christians. I think that this is a singular Messiah role that has different names depending on, like, you know, Melisandre's from Ashai, they call him Azor Ahai. Westeros refers to him as the prince that was promised, but it's the same character. And in fact, I think the fact that Martin refers to them the same way means that, like, that's like a fact. That's like a the word of God kind of fact.
It's in his headcanon.
Yeah. Certainly. So, and it doesn't throw me because, like, Melisandre's talking to a person who is raised in Westeros, and they know that that prophecy is the prince that was promised. So. It didn't bother me. But that's the way I see it there, Ryan. Gerard M., what are your best guesses on who's running the Sons of the Harpy? I'm guessing it's Dario, in the show anyways. It's still not clear in the books, and here's why. Hisdar, one of the other suspects, Hisdar, which is the former husband of Dany, is now dead on the show, so it can't be him unless things are completely different in the books. Two, he double-crosses his allies from the first time we meet him. He actually cut the heads off his commanders and gave them to Dany as a way to turn cloak.
Right.
He knew where to find the guy that was hiding in the walls last season, and in this episode, we learned that they're funded by the Masters and other cities in Slaver's Bay. Which major character in Essos has been in touch with these communities in recent episodes? Dario. If you recall, Dario was returning from, like, some kind of tour of the area last season. So what if, when they rescue Dany, Dario tries to kill her, and Jorah ultimately redeems himself by saving Dany from him? What do you think, Jim?
That could be. He's a smooth operator, if that's the case, because I'm not picking that up from him.
I mean, he could be very much a Lando, going back to Star Wars, a Lando Calrissian type.
And hasn't he been giving her kind of bad advice along the way? But everyone has.
And that's the thing. It depends on your point of view. Like,
right.
It could be advice that he legitimately has as a person who was born into the slave trade as a pit fighter. Like, that's the way he sees the world.
Right.
But it's certainly advice that conflicted with what Barristan was trying to tell her.
Sure, yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, definitely he's a scoundrel, and I could see that happening. And also, it's an easy way for Jorah to kind of prove his worth, I suppose.
Yeah. Could be.
Why? I guess why the real question is, why is Dario doing this? Like, why wouldn't he continue his play for her pants? Because he could end up being the king of the world.
Like, sure.
You know, that's certainly a prize.
Like, he can't think that he can control these dragons, certainly.
Sure. I mean,
he'd be better off with
is like
for
money.
Sure.
Like, that's the old question, is money or power? Like, if you have the option to be the consort of the woman who rules the world, don't you technically have all the money?
Yeah, probably.
Now, if you don't think she can make it, then you can maybe accept a bribe to set yourself up pretty, but you're betting against her. And it doesn't seem like Dario, I don't see any evidence for him betting against her. And that's the one problem. Like, if he thinks she's got a shot, why doesn't he back her?
Okay.
If he doesn't, then fine. But there's nothing that suggests that he doesn't think that she is somewhat special.
Yeah.
But I guess that's why it'd be a shocking betrayal.
Can I throw one other thing out?
Please do.
How about whoever hired Dario and his thugs initially, his mercenaries in the first place?
The second sons, I think they're in.
Dany essentially came along and stole them.
Sure.
By
being pretty,
by being awesome, and Dario's like, oh, okay, I'm going to kill these dudes and come follow you now.
Yeah.
Maybe they're pissed about that. Was it the slavers in What is it? What was the first one? Astapor?
No, I do believe. Yeah, they the one of the cities. Maybe it's Young. I can't. I honestly can't. I can't keep them separate. But yeah, they did hire to keep them to keep her from conquering them.
Right. So maybe they're just pissed now, and they've been regrouping as she's been away.
True.
Because I mean, it has been a struggle for her to even keep Marine under control, let alone these other cities. So I don't know that there needs to be like an inside influence in Marine that's doing this. It could be the outside,
mm-hmm.
just like Varys found out this episode.
Yeah. I still don't... But you're saying that they'd be paying Daario?
No.
Oh, okay.
That they would just be organizing the Sons of the Harpy.
Sure, yeah.
Because, you know, they have motivation, and it's... I think it's an effective demonstration of how little control she has in the region at the moment.
Yeah.
Like, she's just... You know, she did all these things that she thought was going to set things right in the area, and they did momentarily, but...
And Martin's razor would suggest that the thing in the book, or the thing in the show that Varys discovered is a fact, and it's plausible, and we're just going to go with that. Like, this is just a foreign, you know, that these foreign powers are financing the old masters to rise up against Dany.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the straightforward reading of it.
Yep. Back in 5 says, since we're finally seeing more of Sam and Gilly headed to the Citadel, or at least Sam is heading there, are we going to learn more about the shenanigans going on there? Part of the intrigue in the book parts about the Citadel comes from the fact that Jaqen and the Sand Snake Sirella is there. Sam's a POV character in the book, so is it a reasonable inference that what happens at the Citadel is significant? Fuck yeah, it is.
I mean, would assume so.
That's why I was kind of worried about them fucking up the Sand Snakes, because I only care about the Sand Snakes insofar as they do something cool with the Citadel. And the fact that Martin makes it very clear, if you're a clever reader, that Sirella is there, because there's a character that roughly matches her description. Granted, it's a gender bend, but she was also kind of described as a masculine warrior type, which we see, like, the eldest of the Sand Snakes kind of fits that T.
Okay.
Like, she cuts her hair short and wears some armor and, you know, rubs some ash on her. She could pass for, all right. You know.
She could do the Joan of Arc thing.
Yeah.
Why not?
Totally. Or even Arya pulled that shit off, too.
That's true.
Pretending to be a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, essentially it's the person's name spelled backwards. Like, you show up at a place, you know, with your shave, with long hair and fake boobs and your face shaved, and you're going by Midge.
Yep.
I'm calling bullshit. I'm saying, you're Jim. Don't people bullshitting me. But yeah, no, I mean, not just that, but the shit that Sam's already finding out. They're like, there's these crazy magic candles that have not been lit for forever, and now they're lighting, and there's this sorcerer. Magical maester that's kind of getting his own following and recruiting Sam. Like, definitely whatever Sam learns at the Citadel is going to be relevant to what goes on in Westeros. So
yeah,
that's one of the more exciting things about the season. Because most of the other shit, it's like, I've known, I wasn't 100% sure.
Right, and if it wasn't going to be relevant, they would have pulled like a Rickon or a...
Yeah.
Or a Gendry sort of thing with him, and just not shown him.
Sure.
Like, let it fall to the wayside for 3 seasons.
Moving on to Nat. This theory popped up on my Facebook feed. I'm not sure if you talked about it before or not. Is the High Sparrow actually Howland Reed in disguise? Sounds dumb to me, but I'd like to see Jim's reaction now that we've arrived at Howland's appearance in the flashback.
Ugh.
So, if you consult the archives...
Some rough years on that guy.
So if you consult the archive that I put in all the show notes for the spoiler podcast, you'll see that I actually did cover the theory about whether Howland Reed is the High Sparrow.
Huh.
And here's the things that I'm going to just briefly recap, because if you want to hear the whole deal, it's in the archives for a reason. But it's essentially the fact that the descriptions of Howland Reed and the descriptions of the High Sparrow are very similar. And
almost
that,
as if they're written by the same person.
Well, not only that, but like, that's something that Martin does surprisingly a lot in the books, is have one character masquerade as another character, which is why you have all these horse shit, you know, Daario is Euron Greyjoy, and Daario is Benjen Stark, and Benjen Stark is the, you know, it's like, because he does that enough to an annoying degree that, like, he kind of, like, you can't shut down any speculation. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, if these characters have physical similarities, then, oh, is he doing it again? So he's got, like, prominently, they talk about the fact that Howland Reed goes around barefoot. Like, that's one of his defining features. And they talk a lot about the High Sparrow being barefoot and how gross and nasty his feet are.
Okay.
And also, there's a certain amount, this goes with like the Grand Northern Conspiracy, is that we know that there are elements of the North that are infiltrating places down south, and which I'll get to in a bit because we're going to talk more about this Grand Northern Conspiracy. But it would make sense for Stark, one of the most loyal Stark supporters, to be entrusted with the mission to lead an insurgency against the Crown. Mm-hmm. And that's what the High Sparrow is doing. And thus, it would be very cool if he was revealed to be Howland Reed. Like, not only have I worked to bring down the false Lannisters, but I also know that the true Stark is Jon. Everybody give it up for him. Sit him on the Iron Throne. Like, right. It's one of those deals.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting.
So again, if you want to hear the whole scoop, I think it's last season I talked about it, but there's the... and the cool thing about the archive is it's broken down by subject matter, and it not only has the link to the podcast, also has the time code to where you want to skip all the feedback and other bullet. You just want the tinfoil theory, go right to it. Which is important because some of those podcasts are like 2.5 hours long, man.
Yeah.
Especially before I split the spoiler into its own thing. Mm-hmm. Like, that was just part of the main Game of Thrones podcast, and they were long. Holy shit, they were long. Charles F. said, what do you think about the theory that Lyanna Stark is actually giving birth to twins and that Jon and Mira Reed are siblings? I feel like it makes sense, but I haven't heard anyone talk about this recently. How likely do you think this would be? I don't think it's likely at all.
Why?
So this is the spawn of Preston Jacobs, who has a lot of very slickly produced... He has very slickly produced videos.
Okay, first of all.
Yes.
Is this guy's name the spawn of Preston Jacob, or is his name Preston Jake? Like, is he the son of Preston Jacob?
He's the spawn of Preston Jacobs. Was way worse. No.
Okay, his name is...
This theory is the spawn of Preston Jacobs.
Okay, gotcha.
And Satan. It's also the spawn of Satan. He makes very slick videos mm-hmm. that... give you these, like, oh my god, this is so fucking cool vibe.
Right.
And that's where my position was, and probably still would be had I not run a podcast where someone asked me to talk about his theories. Because I want to go through in the books and start looking at the things he cites. Mm-hmm. Holy shit, cherry picking.
Right.
And how he does, like, he likes to find one or two flaws of the main theories and then say, well, then that means R plus L equals J is wrong. It's actually R plus L equals, J and M, Mira and Jojen, or John and Mira. But the thing is his theories have so many more flaws than the thing
right.
that he picked that made him go off from the main shoot anyway.
Right.
And he does a lot of, like... extra textual analysis, like, this is patterns we see in this other literature, therefore Martin is doing it too. And it's like, that shit, like, when you actually start to try to make the pieces fit together, and I'm not trying to start, like, a fucking war with this guy, because, like, what he's doing is cool, and it's making a lot of people happy, and he knows a lot about the source material. Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of thought maybe he was a flim-flam man, and then he did, like, a Ask Me Anything on the Ice and Fire subreddit, and I found he actually held his own on a lot of stuff. So,
yeah,
I have respect. I just don't buy any of his popular theories.
They
if you try to sit down and look at the original text and everything around them, and then ignore all the other hints about the other theories that they're competing against, it's just really hard to say him with a straight face.
Here's what I find troubling about trying to be a YouTuber, a theorizing YouTuber,
yeah,
is that the internet has already figured out probably the most likely of the theories,
sure.
and all you can do is spout them, shit them back out in a slickly produced format.
Sure.
Unless you want to try to branch out, but then most likely you're just making shit up because you are but one person.
Sure.
And
so how likely is it that you're going to find the 10 most compelling theories? They're all original
discoveries. That everyone else has missed.
Sure.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So That's pretty big drawback.
But when it's been 5 years since the last book comes out, sometimes ridiculous looks sublime. And you can get a couple million people to watch your videos.
Sure.
Which, not hating, the last thing I want is like someone to see like, hey, Aaron's talking shit about your and like start this big, although maybe that'd be cool.
And speculation is fun.
In fact, I take it all back. Preston Jacobs, you're the fucking worst.
But the spawn of Preston Jacobs,
I hope you do
a 15-minute
video about Bald Move and how we're a bunch of fucking dumbasses. Be a fate worse than death.
And I hope it gets 100 million clicks.
Yeah, that'd show you, you son of a bitch. With your bullshit theories. Take that, Mr. Jacobs.
But honestly, it's fun to speculate, so I get why people
do this, because
we do it here.
Yeah, and I'm the guy who's like, oh yeah, Bruce Bolton's a vampire. How cool.
Right,
so,
and Tyrion's going to ride a dragon to Westeros and kill Cersei.
Yeah, my only beef was like when I went to go, I would either just regurgitate his video and ignore all the problems with it, or spend three times longer talking about all the ways I didn't think it would be true, which I actually did.
Yeah.
I did that for one of his videos. Okay. It was like a takedown thing rather than a here's a theory and why I think it's cool.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Anyway, let's see. Virgilio in California. Talking about the Ghost of Winterfell plot, can they re-spin this subplot with Rickon committing all of the Bolton murders? In this retelling, Rickon would have been discovered his own warging abilities and thus use Ramsay's own dogs to do the killing. I also got some, this was just a representative example, lots of people suggested that Rickon might be the Ghost of Winterfell. A few more suggested Asha, because we know she's a stone cold killer, could be the Ghost of Winterfell.
Okay.
Yes, because it seems like, I don't usually like to talk about the previews, but what the fuck? The previews show Theon going to his sister on the Iron Islands, so Theon being the Ghost of Winterfell doesn't seem like it's lining up with where the show's going.
No, he's going home.
It's also possible that they're not going to do the Ghost of Winterfell. They're just going to skip to the war at Winterfell. And someone's going to lose, and someone's going to, and there's not any of this inside fighting, which also means a lot of the Grand Northern conspiracy is going to be less conspiracy and more overt. Just fuck you, we're going to war.
Right. The conspiracy will be, you know, just all climax.
Sure.
Right. Like it's been there, and then now, boom, it's happening.
Yep. Yeah, it's now the noose is tight around your neck, and you're already swinging before you know it.
Yeah.
Daniel J. from Detroit says, I've often wondered if the term many-faced god is a euphemism for coins, and that the faceless man's ideology is thus a non-ideology of assassination for hire. In other words, if they are principled about not having principles and money is the only thing they respect, Arya's entire story seems to be set up for a single meaningful assassination, and the best source of money to pay for that key assassination at this point is the Iron Bank. Makes me wonder if they will take a hit out on King's Landing now that they've welched on their debts. Could you see Arya assassinating Tommen, fulfilling the prophecy of Maggie the Frog, and then taking Tommen's face and posing as the king to further some amazing plot point? Whoa, whoa, whoa. You went a little crazy at the end there. But Arya assassinating Tommen for welching out on the crown's debts? Sure, I could see that.
All right.
I also don't know that I agree with your faceless men euphemism for coin. That's a really cool concept in theory, and it would make them like the Scientology of Westeros, where the people on top know it's all about the money, but the people that are the foot soldiers and they think it's like this big religious calling,
right?
But that's kind of cool too.
Yeah, it's interesting that they are headquartered in the same city as the Iron Bank. And that's, you know, the coin was what got her over there in the first place. Sure. Like,
that's their sim. That's their calling card, right?
Right. There's something to that. Maybe it's Jack and Miss Cavage. Maybe that's his last name.
All I know is Daniel is like,
change it to Hagar after.
He's already got 2 minutes of a 10-minute Preston Jacobs video. So you take what you got in this email and you add a couple more. So I just gave you a free one. Their calling card is a coin.
There you go.
Like, there you're 4 minutes into it.
Man.
You got
Can
six
you imagine
more
a YouTube video with a picture of a coin spinning?
Sure.
For 4 minutes while you explain it.
Oh, yeah.
Start your account right now. The spawn of Preston Jacobs. Do it.
Spawn of Jacobs. Kyle from Australia says, during the final scene of episode 3 where Jon Snow hangs the Night's Watch traitors, I had a thought on the direction that a show could go with this plotline. With the Lady Stoneheart storyline possibly not making it to the HBO series and the show's history of combining characters or condensing numerous book storylines into single character storylines for the show, aka Martin's Razor, do you think we could see a colder, more merciless Jon Snow with characteristics and similar story arcs to that of the resurrected Catelyn Stark, aka Lady Stoneheart? We could potentially see Jon heading south towards Winterfell with his Red Priestess and band of wildling companions, bringing Bolton loyalists on his way to reclaiming the North, while Sansa and Davos can rally the rest of the northern houses that are still loyal to the Starks. Do you see a slightly more vengeful Jon Snow possibly being the much more vengeful Lady Stoneheart in the show?
I mean, they wouldn't call him Lady Stoneheart, I don't think, but...
Well, I mean...
Maybe. I mean, I'm still really pulling just because it's cool for Lady Stoneheart. But yeah, I mean, Jon is clearly on a mission at this point to get up to no good in the North. Actually, to get up to good in the North.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume we've got a big clash at Winterfell coming very soon.
And I guess it just comes down to how you saw that final scene, because I did not see that as Jon excited or vengeful at all. It was very much of resignment and sorrow, and I don't even know if he did it except for it's he knew it needed to be done, and he believes, like his father, or I guess uncle before him, that the man who sings the man who gives a sentence swings the sword.
Right.
Which, by the way, oh my God, there is a couple of pedants on the subreddit talking about how they couldn't believe that Jon hung people instead of beheading them, because that's not the Stark way.
Yeah, he's not a Stark, eh?
Well, it's true. Not fully one, anyway.
Not yet. He's about to become one, I think, pretty soon.
A Tark.
Right, and
Stargaryen.
What's the Night's Watch way? Because that's what he's doing up there, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's the thing. He's beheaded before.
He has, right?
But that's the thing. Like,
but
I don't.
You don't have to. Just because you behead once doesn't have to make you behead all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, get some variety in there. It's the spice of life,
Jon. If that's
John,
the thing that turns you off of the show, then I can't believe you're still watching, honestly.
I mean, they've burnt people up there alive. Like,
yeah.
The varied ways to kill people at the Wall.
But this one dick in particular, like, copied and pasted the same fucking paragraph said the same thing about the swing of the sword to like 10 different responses in the same chain. I'm like, oh Jesus, someone please.
Yeah,
I did my part. Down votes galore. That's the thing, like, I've never done this before, but I almost like created more accounts to downvote him further, and I'm like, you know what, that's when you know you've had too much Reddit.
Yeah,
time to shut down the browser.
Yep.
Let's see. Jessica D says, in the books, Kevin Lannister gets killed by Varys. Since this is most likely not going to happen as Varys is hundreds of miles away, it seems like the show is creating cause for Cersei to get stabby. The show has started to create the divide by not allowing her on the council. In addition, I can see Kevin not wanting to go to war with the Faith of the Seven because his son, Lancel, is part of that group.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
I know. It is. People forget. I would actually be okay if Cersei kills Kevin as it goes along with her character's need for control, power, and revenge. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if she's speculating that it has to be Cersei's own hands. She'll probably send
it could be a cat's ball.
Robert.
Sure.
Or the, you know.
Yeah.
But sure, I think she definitely could.
The thing I guess... So Varys kills Kevin at the end of the last book, and he explains it just because, like, hey, look, man, you're actually a decent hand of the king. You might turn this around, and I can't have you doing that, so you're dead.
Wow.
And it's a really cool scene. I kind of want to see it, and they've made the Narrow Sea... Like, I know we've talked about it being... that people kind of hop back and forth across it at will. And I kind of would forgive them if... And this would be like more of an end of the season thing, I think, to have King's Landing get thrown into an uproar. I'm fine with him coming over. Like, it can be implausibly short amount of time. Like, if they need to warp time and space to make that awesome scene happen, I think Cersei's completely, like, the way you lined it out here, Jessica, this makes a lot of sense. I'm just hoping that we get to see Varys put the crossbow into his guts, the bolt in his guts.
I've got another option.
Or maybe it's poison.
You.
I can't honestly remember.
Yeah, Varys has his ways.
Yes, he does.
Another option, a guy who is a lot like Varys and is closer, is Littlefinger. And he has access, right?
No,
he can get back in, no problem.
Yeah.
Maybe he could do it.
He's got...
For the same reasons, roughly, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to take down the Lannister thing for my own reasons.
I want to see myself on the throne. You're too good. Too
good
a hand.
You gotta go. Maybe. I don't know. He's closer, anyway.
Nicole S. I see Grand Northern Conspiracy written all over D'Umber's decision to bring Rickon to Winterfell. The show is moving faster than the books with this theory. What better place than Winterfell to showcase the last remaining male Stark heir? Umber refused all the traditional ways of submitting to his overlord in exchange for presenting a gift. No bending of a knee, no oaths to keep secrets, just the gift of Rickon Stark. By bringing a Stark home, they are perfectly seated to overthrow the Boltons from inside and place Rickon in the seat, giving the Grand Northern Conspiracy a place to work from. We may have to see the Umbers play friendly with Ramsay for an episode, but with Jon renouncing his watch and heading south, is the only way he can go. Winterfell will be on his radar to help Rickon's cause, especially if he meets Sansa on the way. Have we talked about the Grand Northern Conspiracy in any kind of detail?
I don't think so.
Because here's the problem. I think it was either a 2 or 3-part podcast series the last time I touched on it, because it's truly sprawling. And it's one of those things where the devil is very much in the details. Like, a plain reading of the count does not lead you to... Well, it definitely... There's definitely the first step reveals are a lot more subtle, but I think there's a couple of two-step reveals, especially the one that's most notable is Lord Manderly essentially gives a speech to Davos, because Davos is trying to rally all the northern lords to Stannis' cause, because Stannis is still alive at this point. And, you know, he goes and this Lord Manderly, who's a Stark loyalist, is entertaining Freys. And, like, you know, overtly showing his support. But when he gets behind closed doors with Davos, he says, this is all bullshit. My son died at the Red Wedding, and it's murder. I don't give a shit what these Boltons and Freys say. And I've been patient. I'm biding my time. But soon this farce is going to be done. The North remembers. And it's like all the book readers, like, fucking about time. But... So, just to sketch it out, there's this theory that all the Northern Lords are working together with other key people in Westeros. One is the, perhaps, Howland Reed as the High Sparrow. Mm-hmm. There's also this thing that Lady Stoneheart has taken over the Brotherhood Without Banners. And then, so Jaime's got this arc where he goes through the Riverlands to bring, like, this is after the War of the Five Kings. He's essentially bringing all these lords back into the King's Peace by making deals and... crushing rebellions and whatnot. He first steps off at the in the Riverlands, and he goes to the Tullys, which is being their castle is still being held by the Blackfish, the elder Cat's brother. He's still flying a Stark banner and everything. So Jaime treats with him, and he organizes a surrender of the castle. But at the last minute, the Blackfish jumps into the river and swims underneath the gate and escapes. That's a card that's still in play. Also, there's a couple of people, like, for example, the person mentioned one of Ned's men-at-arms that was with the Brotherhood Without Banners that he sent to, you know... Man, I don't know where to stop devolving. This is why this turns into a two-podcast thing. Ned sent Beric Dondarrion with a bunch of his dudes and other lords to go bring Gregor Clegane to justice in Season 1, as he does in the books as well.
Okay.
That became the Brotherhood Without Banners once Ned was executed. They decided, like, fuck all the nobles. We're going to look out for the little guys. And they kind of became the Robin Hood of their time. There's a couple of characters. There's one particular, a bard, that shows up hanging around the camp of some Lannister men that Jaime goes to visit. And there's also the Ned Stark's man-at-arms that shows up at Winterfell, and the Ghost of Winterfell theory. There's also a plot that I do not believe is in the TV series, where Rob is, before a big battle, is worried that what would happen to my house if I was dead. Because Bran and Rickon are too young, Sansa and Arya are kind of in the wind, and he writes a royal decree that all of his northern men and mother witness, that legitimizes Jon as a Stark and names him as his heir. Now, then Rob dies, and no one knows what happens to the will, but the gist of the Grand Northern Conspiracy is that there are key northern people who know about this will and have possession of it, and they're going to try to make Jon the king of the north. There's also some offshoots that say someone's recovered Rickon, because, like, Lord Manderly sends Davos off. He's like, if you can bring me back Rickon, my liege lord, then I'll listen to your, you know, I might consider helping out Stannis.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some people to say that's just a plot that the Manderlys are using to throw Davos off the true intent, which is to put Jon on the Iron Throne, or not the Iron Throne, the King of the Stark Throne.
Yeah.
So, again, there's a lot more textual evidence in the books about all this stuff, but that's the general kind of plot for the Grand Northern Conspiracy.
Okay. And in this, like, I'm...
So everyone's trying to see this Umber thing as a way to fit that in. And I don't know... I did too, but this week's episode makes it damn hard to see how this is helping the Starks.
Right.
If it was a fake Rickon...
And we've talked about, you know, glamming people and, like, that sort of thing.
I don't think the Umbers can do that.
Right, but I... Like, it's in the world. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The fact that it's actual, because the thing is, you know, Ramsay having this...
A lot of things
this,
have changed, though. Like, Little John doesn't die at the Red Wedding, and, like, there's just a bunch of things that are different here.
Sure. And that's what I'm saying. Like, it seems like they're taking this story as... And the other thing is, using some knowledge that I gleaned from the trailers, is it does look like there's tons of Umber banners with the... Bolton banners. They're at this battle. They show in the trailer this battle between these guys and the wildling army led by Jon, which that happened somehow. So it could be. I don't know if this is a situation like, remember in Braveheart, where the Irishmen were sent out to go soften up Braveheart, whatever the fuck his name was, armies, and it ends that he's defected.
Right.
Like, it'd be interesting if they sent the Umbers as the vanguard to go smash the Wildling army, and they just, like, hey, we're Starkmen, we're joining you.
Yeah, or, I mean, the most obvious thing, I mean, this is a terrible move if Ramsay actually goes for this, because, you know, his dad was all about, let's keep the defensive position here in Winterfell. If he sends out all his armies to help with these Wildlings, well, we know there are other armies on the way. Littlefinger is... probably on route at this point.
Yeah.
So he's not going to have anything left behind. And if the Umbers know this somehow, if maybe Littlefinger is doing something here with the conspiracy, depending on what you think about whether or not he was trying to help Sansa or not.
Right.
Maybe he's involved in this, and he's purposely putting Rickon in a position where he'll be safe back at Winterfell, and then also getting Ramsay's troops out of the way.
Yeah.
So he can swoop in and both save Rickon and also take Winterfell.
There's also a scene, there's also something in the books, a little bit more of complex version of what happens with Winterfell, where Robb sends a detachment of his men back to go kick the Ironborn out and to reclaim Winterfell. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a more complicated name. I'm explaining, but I'm trying to condense it for Jim and time. Roose Bolton sends Ramsay with a detachment, like he does in the books. They act like they're going to join the Stark men, but they end up turning against them and murdering them all, and then laying siege to Winterfell and taking it for themselves, which is kind of what happens. I wonder if it's going to be like the Boltons are going to do that in reverse. Mm-hmm. Like, they claim to be supporting Ramsay, they get on the field of battle, and then they just turn on them and butcher them where the Umbers kill
all of Ramsay's troops. Yeah. Sure.
Or it could be that they're telling the story of, like, kind of the new, younger Lords of the North that don't feel a particular loyalty to Stark, and there might be, you know, there might be some latent anger or jealousy there for various reasons that they've set up or not in the show, and that this is a story of Jon just having to crush that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing they're definitely saying is, with all this stuff about Roose being like, yeah, we need to keep the defensive position, you're not strategic, like, all this kind of stuff, Roose knows better, Ramsay doesn't, now that Roose isn't there to guide him, I think Ramsay, that's the mistake he's going to make, is not following through on what his father wanted, staying in Winterfell, you know, hold up, ready for a siege. I think that's going to be his downfall. That seems to me what the show is saying.
Therese M. adds that she thinks that with Bran's new, you know, Weirwood vision warging powers, that he'll have a vision of Robb writing the royal decree legitimizing Jon Snow as Jon Snark and giving it...
Jon Snark. Yeah.
Jon Snow as Jon Stark.
Okay, that's a YouTube account too.
Jon Snark. Uh-huh. And it probably already exists. And giving it to Brendan Tully, the Blackfish, for safekeeping. By the time Jon arrives at Winterfell, he'll be crowned King of the North. With the North united once again, Jon could prepare for the bigger war coming, the White Walkers. Okay. So the Tower of Joy is one thing. Do you think if they start using Bran's... The one thing I'm worried about is they start using Bran's powers to just answer every little question, that's going to start feeling like a little, you know, Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't know that I want that to be the final word.
But these revelations have to be kind of A, somewhat novel and sparingly used, and B, you know, stuff that, like, it's reasonable for us show watchers to not, and for Bran to not know that information, but there's no reason why we wouldn't see Jon doing something this important. It would feel cheating to withhold that information. Whereas the Ned stuff with the Tower of Joy, that was all set up as a deliberate mystery for us to wonder about.
Right.
This would just be like, oh, well, we didn't have the cameras on when Jon was doing, or Robb was doing this momentous thing of declaring an heir and legitimizing his bastard brother. And
right.
Oh,
it's,
sorry.
It's stuff we could have seen, whereas yes, we couldn't have seen this Tower
of Joy
before,
stuff. Sure. Right. Yeah. So that, I think that's the difference, and that's where I hope they don't go down that route too far.
Yeah.
Naomi says, hey guys, you may have already gotten feedback on this, but I want to suggest another reason behind the title Oathbreaker. And she included a video on YouTube of the scene where the great Jon Umber first swears fealty to Robb as the King of the North. At first, you'll recall that he threatens Robb with essentially arresting and hanging him as an Oathbreaker against the King. And then Robb's wolf bites off his fingers and he declares him the King of the North.
Okay.
But he specifically uses this that I'll have you slain as an Oathbreaker. All right, so after summarizing this, she continues, considering the title of this season, 6th episode, I think it's obvious that we're seeing the start of a Grand Northern Conspiracy. The title comes from a scene where the Umbers cemented their alliance to the Starks, a scene where not doing so meant being hanged. I know the Ladies of Dorne have done a 180 from their portrayal in the book, but I can't imagine the Umbers would change so much between seasons 1 and 6. I think the time will come when the Umbers will rise up and remind Ramsay about what happens to those who betray their liege lords. Jim, do you think that Oathbreaker title is actually harkens back to what the great Jon said to Robb, and that this is like a reversal of this situation?
Maybe. I mean, you know, it applies in a lot of different ways to a lot of different people. It's a thematic thing, I guess. It could.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That seems like a big ask to remember that far back in the show. But, you know, the internet has an infinite memory, so...
Yeah, you get the book readers already kind of like prejudiced against Umbers being traitors, but I think if they show the right previously ons, just like they set the stage with the Karstarks by showing essentially 6 seconds from season 3.
Right.
They could do the same thing with the Great John. Though, I don't know, maybe it's harder to show that the Great Johns were the first ones to kind of embrace him as the king. I don't know.
Right, yeah.
But that's going to spoil. That's the thing, like, you know, I was reading one review where someone said, thank God they didn't show Rickon and Asha in the previously ons. Like, they had to trust that you would recognize them, because if they did, it would spoil the surprise. Yeah. If they show the Umbers being like, oh, the king in the north, and then the Umbers betrayal, it'll kind of spoil the surprise. Because right now,
right, and they,
the book reader in me wants to say, no, fuck yeah, Grand Northern Conspiracy, Umbers are total Stark men. But the show watcher's like, yeah, but what the fuck? Giving, like, everyone's saying, like, this is helping the Starks by having, I don't think so, because Ramsay's right. a fucking psycho.
Sure. You don't want your kids mixed up
he's
with Ramsay.
He's already Warden of the North. Why? What is, I guess, a living Stark could be used as ransom against the other Northern Lords, but that,
right.
But by using that logic, then the Northern Lords want him to be alive and the Warden of the North. So it's like,
yeah,
it's something you can use to threaten him with, but it's also like hope eternally springing alive, because there's still a Stark in Winterfell, and we need to figure out a way we can fucking betray Ramsay.
Right, and I think Roose would have figured this out.
Sure.
I just don't think Ramsay sees it.
Well, and even Roose is like, you're going to attack Jon Snow. Mm-hmm. All the Northern Lords will be against us. Ramsay's like, nuh-uh. And then a Northern Lord comes up and says, hey, I'll help you attack Jon Snow.
Yeah. Yeah. He's being set up as a fool. Sure. And I think he is. So
Sean from Kansas says, in the show, does Jaime know about Cersei having sex with her cousin Lancel? I don't think Tyrion told him at the end of season 4. It could be a revelation that will drive a wedge between the two of them again. I would love to see Jaime leave King's Landing and get involved with other characters again, perhaps Brienne. I mean, that's the question. Why? Because that all happens in the books. And in the show, they've had a rift between them, and then it gets healed, and now they're working together. But I feel like thematically, and from a narrative standpoint, Jaime and Brienne have to get together, not in a romantic sense, but in a storytelling, you know, finishing their tale together kind of sense. In which in the book is helped by him being pissed off at Cersei and being wounded that she cheated on him, and then him going on this mission to pacify the lands, and then he eventually comes into contact with Brienne again. Why? I maybe it's just that, like, they wanted to make sure Jaime was prominent in the show the whole time because he's an awesome actor. He's a cool character. So they're like, well, fuck, we got to have him plausibly staying in King's Landing instead of, I mean, they sent him on Dorne, which he didn't do in the... I don't know. I really don't know what the fuck they're doing with him.
It's tough to say.
Because I was excited. I remember being excited at him going to Dorne. I'm like, well, that's great. Because, you know, like, what he does is kind of interesting in the books. But, you know, if he's actually down there doing stuff... But then I saw Dorne, and I'm like, well, fuck.
Right.
So, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine, Sean. Jeannie Ness. I have a weird feeling that the fart was playing homage to book readers in honor of Gareth the Gross, a Tyrell who had been chosen by Tywin and Mace to act as Master of Coin, but who was stopped by Cersei. Garth's claim to fame, besides being good with numbers, was that he was a flatulent, hence his nickname.
Wow.
Okay. That's an obscure wink, because I did forgotten about that, but it's a fact. Tywin and Mace both are trying to make him master the coin, and they talk about him farting a lot.
God.
So maybe farts in a small council is a canonical thing that they're just desperately trying to work in.
Okay. All right. I give him a little more credit.
That's actually, I don't know that you spoil the moment in the show just to do that kind of wink, but... Especially when you're just fucking wantonly changing dialogue of beloved characters that people have been looking forward to for 20 years. We've been wanting to see the Tower of Joy, and it's all Luke, I'm your daddy.
But it's at least it's not apropos of nothing. Like, there's a reason for it, because it's in the books.
It's a fear and fart? So, okay.
Right, for having farts in the inner chambers of King's
Landing.
Because
there's a lot of silly shit in the books that Martin does for just, like, in, you know, jokes. And, like, 1-1, for example, he's a New York Giants fan. The
1-1 is?
No. George R. R. Martin, thank you for being the second person in the room that catches me when I do shit like that. So Martin's a New York Giants fan. One of the most storied quarterbacks in Giants history, at least until Eli showed up, is Phil Sims, whose jersey number is 11, literally 1-1.
Okay.
And Martin said that, oh yeah, that's totally... There's also like a Bill Belichick joke about some evil force in Westeros. I just want that to be true secretly.
Okay,
but I feel like there's a Bill Belichick joke in there as well. So yeah, he's not above doing things like that, and this might be a reverse wink.
Right,
I don't know. But yeah, still, let's make that be the last fart. In the if history is great conversations in elegant places, farting in the small council chambers is not great history,
right?
Oh boy, this is a tough one. Guillaume K, as I think how you pronounce that name.
Guillaume
is it Guillaume?
I would assume. Yeah.
G-U-I-L-L-A-U-M-E.
Yeah.
Is Guillaume?
Guillaume.
Uh-huh. Okay, there you go. Thanks for saving me again, partner. I was wondering what they are going to do with Gilly's baby in the TV show. In the book, she is taking Mance's baby with her and Sam on the way to the Citadel to avoid Melisandre's flames. It's the old baby switcheroo.
Okay.
They're worried that Melisandre will burn Mance's baby, so they leave Gilly's baby at the wall, and she takes this fake baby with her. In the show, I think they totally avoid that part, and she's taking care of her own baby. Keeping Mance's baby alive seems to be a very important thing for John and might still come into play in the books. Possibly in the books, but in the show, that tells me this whole thing with Mance and the baby switcheroo is not going to amount to a hill of beans.
Does Mance have a baby in the show?
Not in the show, in the books.
Okay.
There's a wildling princess that he's gotten child with.
And, gotcha. So it doesn't seem like they're doing any of that in the show.
And I think that what John really cared about is making sure babies don't get burnt in the fires. So
seems like a decent thing to do.
That part of his character is a caring part is well established in the show. I don't, you know.
Right.
And he's trying to get Gilly. I mean, I think it all tracks clean. But I do think it means bad news for any man's baby theories. Brent H. said, part of the prophecy of the prince that was promised is the notion of being born under a bleeding star. And you'll recall in the previous seasons of the Game of Thrones, they made a point about there was a red comet during the War of the Five Kings.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people suggest that that's the sign of when this Messiah is coming. But Brett's got another theory. At the end of the Tower of Joy scene shows a young Ned Stark walking up the stairs still holding a blood-stained Dawn, which I'm going to talk about here in a minute. Assuming we're soon to see the R plus L equals J theory confirmed inside the tower, this could be a partial proof that Jon is Azor Ahai reborn. Okay, so part of the prophecy is he's born under a bleeding star. The thing that's interesting about Sir Arthur Dayne is he holds the title Sword of the Morning, which is this... kind of like the first Sword of Braavos deal, where it's a special title for the family's most skilled swordsman. And as part of that office, he carries their ancestral blade called Dawn. Now, Dawn is not a Valyrian steel blade, but it's kind of just as cool. It's actually hammered out from metal recovered from meteor, which they referred to as a shooting star. Their keep is called Starfall. Their sigil has literally like a comet on it, like a falling star. So if you got this, and I watched this carefully because at first I thought, well, Ned just took his own sword, but he kills Arthur Dayne with his own sword. And in the show, they make it clear that this is, I think, Dawn. They don't acknowledge it, but it's got this like starburst on its hilt. Its blade is etched with all this fancy filigree shit. I think it's supposed to be the special sword. And Ned drags it up the stairs, and it's dripping with blood. So, like, I don't know it'll be a show thing, but it's kind of cool if it's a book thing that what fulfills the prophecy is Ned going up there with, you know, this bleeding star. I think that's there's something to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good catch on that. Ishmael P. Oh, that's the other thing, is some people think that Dawn is Lightbringer, which is the sword that the prince that was promised is supposed to carry. I don't know what this does for that theory, because the show has not, I mean, other than the prop guy giving a shit about making Dawn look cool, they haven't acknowledged the fact that it's special in any way.
Okay.
It's not Valyrian steel, but it's said to be like its own kind of special and considered as good as Valyrian steel, if not a little bit better. Ishmael P. says, I'm currently trying to wrap my head around the metaphysics in Game of Thrones, and one of the issues I'm having is understanding what Leaf meant when she told Bran and Mira that the magic used to resurrect the Whites doesn't work here. Does that mean that there's a spell that neutralizes White Walker magic, or does it mean that the annihilation of opposites occur when the magic of the children clashes with the White Walker's magic? Do you have, like, before I weigh in here, do you have, like, a gut feeling on this?
Sure, it's magic. It means literally what it says. It doesn't work in this area. Like,
yeah.
Who knows why? Do you have insight into this?
No, just in the books, they mention that there's, like, special warding spells, which is a thing in fantasy.
Okay.
And both the wall and, which is why the White Walkers sent that dead body. Like, that dead body couldn't, that tried to kill the Lord Commander in Season 1, it couldn't walk on its own. The Black Brothers had to drag it back to Castle Black, and then it reanimated and went to go kill him. And a lot of people speculate that's because there's a literal uncrossable barrier there.
Okay.
Also, the white, the Cold Hands, the derangerish white that escorts Bran and Mira and Jojen in the books to the Cave of the Three-Eyed Crow, he also cannot cross the wall.
Hmm.
He has to wait for them to come across and get through their own self, and then he meets them on the other side and takes them. So there is some evidence that the wall is special, and then whatever's special about the wall also applies to the Weirwood cave, that the maybe the Blood Raven's power protects them both. I don't know. It's, again, like I said, it's magic. We'll see if they make something of it from the show. Tomer P. says, in the books, there's an arc to Jaime's character that makes sense. He loses his hand. That gives him pause. He goes back to King's Landing, starts his life from fresh. He stares at the white page and the white book and wonders what he can accomplish with his life. Not as a young and vain Jaime who thinks he'll just be the best fighter and all the other things will fall into place, but as handless Jaime who understands that the vows of knighthood sometimes conflict and who lost his ability to fight, who must make a plan and make a mark on the world using his Lannister cunning and his position as Lord Commander. He's hurt by Cersei's betrayal, the only woman he's ever loved. He sees she's losing it when she's in trouble, and he realizes that he has to move on. He's also furious about Lancel, the Kettlebacks, and the Moonboy, for all he knows, fucking Cersei. In the show, Cersei confesses to sleeping with Lancel, but Jaime doesn't seem to care. She's clearly off her rocker, but doesn't seem to mind. He doesn't seem to mind. He had a scene with Joff and the White Book, which seemed like a pivotal moment. In Season 3, he had this amazing sequence with Brienne in the bath, and that he was on the road to be reinvented. So why is he now cooperating with Cersei? Why doesn't he tell her to go fuck herself when he wants to join the small council? If he didn't bring Cersei, his Uncle Kevin might have accepted him. Cersei doesn't even have the right to be there. And what is this jokey business with Sir Gregor? Is he now just a tag-along clown to make jokes around Cersei's anger? Why is he toying with him? Why is he being an idiot? What's the purpose of this character in the show anymore?
Good questions.
I think he has a fair point. Like, Jaime seems to have lost the plot of his own damn plot.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of surprised that three episodes in, like, okay, you sit him down to Dorne. Three episodes in, what the fuck is he doing? He's on Team Lannister. That can't last.
Yeah, and I would say, like, he's there to execute on the revenge for Marcella, but it seems like Cersei could do that.
Yeah.
On her own.
Yeah.
I don't know. He like, I'm becoming less interested in him as time goes on. Like,
it's a bummer.
He used to be one of my favorite characters.
Sure.
Now it's just kind of, he's there, and he might come back and do something cool soon, but...
That sucks, man, because he is one of the better characters in the books, and...
You're right. They need something for him to do.
And it's been, like, a good moment. Like, ever since he came back and raped the queen over his son's body,
right. Like,
he's been a fundamentally less interesting and kind of on-hold character. I guess, like, I imagine the Double D's will be like, motherfucker, we sit
the
in Dorne.
Stuff, sure, but...
And I'm like, well, we didn't care about Dorne,
And all of it was kind of bad, so...
Sure, yeah. That's the response to that. Gretchen says, now that we've finally seen how Howland Reed looked like when he was young, did anyone notice any likenesses to the High Sparrow? I did not. And in fact, the age seems like it just cannot possibly work.
Oh, really?
Oh, I mean, did
yeah, he, like that guy to Ned.
Did he seem like he was the same age as Ned? It seemed to me.
Yeah, roughly, yeah.
Whereas the High Sparrow looks like he's a good 20 years older than Ned.
For sure.
Now, if he lifts up his robes to expose himself to Tommen, because he's that kind of high priest, and he's got a big, knife wound in his gut, well, then maybe Howland Reed's back on. But then why is Howland Reed molesting boy kings?
And why is he aged 40 years and 20?
Well, You take a knife wound from the Sword of Mourning, and that really ages a man.
Maybe so.
But no, it does seem like that is more of a cool theory that's not actually going to be true in a show.
Maybe they'll recast a Sparrow next season, the High Sparrow.
There you go.
He'll be 20 years younger, and then all of a sudden, here comes Hallen Reed.
This was the Sparrow the Dingy version. They need the right. They need a younger, beanier, brawnier Sparrow next season,
mm-hmm.
Played by Sean Bean.
Oh, God, that'd be confusing.
Scott R. says, I have an overarching question as to what you guys think Germ's involvement is with the series at this point. He stepped in to write an episode here or there in the early going, but he does not seem to make any further indication of that. Is he too busy with the Winds of Winter? I guess that makes sense. Do you think there's any possibility or even preference by Germ and the Double Ds to see the next books released after the series has ended to just avoid ongoing comparisons with the show as it is airing? I've also heard you talk of Germ's three-stage reveal in the books and how it is hard to execute with the number of podcasts and aftershows out. I mean, I didn't figure out R plus L equals J, but I heard about it now, and I'm just expecting it and will be shocked if it does not pan out. Do you think that George is sick of this exposure and would want the books to stand on their own as much as possible going forward? I think this would be more possible at least once the series is over and regular coverage of the show on a weekly basis has subsided. So there's two parts in this.
His involvement, I honestly can't speculate. I don't know anything about it.
He has been... So George Martin started as a television show writer. That's how, in fact...
Really?
I think
what did
his,
he write?
Beauty and the Beast. The old Linda Hamilton or? And who's the guy that played Hellboy? Ron Perlman joint.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay.
That he got to start with that. And... so he wrote scripts before he wrote novels is what I'm saying. And I know he's enjoyed writing for the show, and he wrote episodes in the first three, maybe four seasons before, you know, Winds of Winter just was dragging on. And he mentioned in his blogs that he's not writing an episode, and he's severely curtailed his con appearances and all this other stuff to try to focus up and get the Winds of Winter out. So I don't think it's, I hate the showrunners and what they're doing with my
right.
shit and fuck all them, because he's always been complimentary and kindly, and he's been to all the premieres and whatnot.
Can you imagine George Martin in the writer's room? Like, George, we hired you to do the finale, but it's, like, due tomorrow.
Yeah, we're shooting tomorrow.
You've handed in three pages. What is this?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, you've released all of this shit on the internet as
well,
preview
you see,
chapters.
I'm a gardener, like, and the things haven't sprouted yet. What are you going to do?
But we need it. We need it, George.
Yeah. So I don't think there's any bitterness or maliciousness. Now, the second part of this question is much more interesting. Is there a gentleman's agreement between Germ and the Double Ds that he's not going to release any more books until the series is out? Just because at this point, it would be a clusterfuck. Like, oh, now the book's going to leapfrog. It's like a fucking horse race. Who's
yeah.
going to, you know, we know the show is going to finish first. But
that's 3 years from now.
Three?
Well, two. Two and some change. Two and 10 weeks. Two
okay,
and two
sure.
and 8 weeks.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
That's a long time
Did that
for
have any
a
book.
To, yeah, a book that people have been anticipating for 5 years to be delayed another two.
I feel
just
like
just for that is.
I feel like if this show completes without the Winds of Winter being released, I'm going to assume that it's the books will never be finished
right?
by Martin.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah.
To delay this book.
Yeah.
So I hope that's not the case, although I could see why you would want it to be the case.
Yeah,
I mean, can you imagine the plot inconsistencies that would happen in both the book and the show? And like,
and it's kind of like the worst of both worlds. Like, you know, you were kind of have a ripping the Band-Aid moment off here where the fans are like, you know what, fuck it. We're going to get the end of the story and then we can get the expanded version, because the show, even when it's successful, is always the less nuanced and political
right.
and adult of the two. It's the highlights, right?
Just because of the format, sure.
Yeah. It's not a slam. It's just like it's different. So I feel like releasing a book in between the run of the show at this point is going to be the worst of all worlds, because now it's going to be polarizing again. Because I feel like 90% of the fans are like, well, fuck it. It's the book's the book, the show's the show. If you start mixing it up, I don't know, because all these, like, it's not as good as the book. And now, it will quell some stuff. The people that are bitching about Stannis burning Shireen, like, that stuff is either going to happen in the books, or it's going to happen in a way that you can see, well, that was a good way to adapt it, or it's going to not, in which case that would really stir up the shit. Like, if that's just more shit that they're doing, like, I don't know.
Yeah. It almost might be smarter to wait, but people aren't going to be happy about another two-year delay on the books.
Well, no, and not some of the people that will not be happy are the publishers of his fucking book. You know,
maybe what he should do is,
and his agent and his pocketbook,
over the next 2 years, write the damn books, keep them in his pocket, and then release them both. Like, just boom, mic drop.
Double release,
yeah.
Or do it like a year apart.
Yeah,
why
maybe.
Wouldn't you just release them both? Like, just double your money.
Just wanted to on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be an interesting idea. Because that would be, I mean...
Because it would give him time, right? Two more years, maybe he could pump something out if he
Well, because it seems
really
to
tries.
Me that the end should be easy to write. It's always been, like, and this is something he's always said, like, you know, the beginning really flowed... You know, the end is going to be, but man, getting everybody to where they need to be, once you get them there, it seems like it's just, you got these pins set up, it's time to knock them down.
I guess.
I can't imagine writing the end of something if you've had it in mind all along, it would be the harder. So I really do, like, if with Wins coming out, I think you're 2-3 years away from the Latin. Now, I could be naive, but I always thought it's like, once Wins gets out, you're 2 or 3 years away from the final book. But I guess I would have said that after Dance of Dragons is over, too, because he said the same fucking thing about Feast and Dance. Like, oh, it's the mirror and he's not, and I'm all knotted up here, and I got Danny here, and I got these people there, and I got the bed of being, you know.
Yeah.
Like, so that seems like he didn't get all of his knots unknotted. So I don't know. I don't know. It's a fucking weird situation.
Yep.
And we'll see. So, I mean, I guess if, like, the Winds comes out right after the final season, is that evidence that there's a gentleman's agreement?
Maybe. It might be some small support for it.
Yeah. Until someone spills the beans.
Yeah.
Like, I think that George, I always like to presume good faith. I think George will release the damn book as soon as it's done.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see any, like, yeah... In a perfect world, they'd hold it, but, like, this isn't the perfect world, and I can't see any of the interest aligning to where he would just sit on it for that long.
Yeah.
Just don't... I mean, for nothing else, he's just the fan expectation, if he cares at all, even if he cares 1%.
Follow the money, Aaron.
Yeah?
The truth is out there.
Sure. Well, maybe the latest Panama files will have indications that these are all stored in offshore accounts.
The books.
The books
are in safe deposit boxes, yeah, in Switzerland, uh-huh, uh-huh, or some
he
shit.
Made the devil. He made the devil's handshake when he signed with HBO.
Oh, man.
HBO's not television, goddammit.
Just think, book readers, you could be reading them right now, if not for HBO.
And the double Ds.
I call for a boycott.
Maybe some faceless men. No. Good God. Do I need to make sure that everyone knows that's a joke, that I'm not advocating killing anybody?
Okay. Yeah.
Just want to make sure for the disturbed people there that, you know, might want to break into Jodie Foster's house and say she's your wife and girlfriend. Like, that's
specifically
not cool.
You, Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah.
We know you're out there. We know you're a fan.
All right. That's all I got. If you'd like to send in more, we got the Game of Thrones at baldmove.com email. Mailbag. We got forums at baldmove.com where there's the spoiler speculation galore. That's also where you can find the correction thread if I fucked up, and I know I have. But thanks for everybody for their support and for listening and for downloading, and especially for all the word of mouth we're getting. Everybody rate and review us and mention us on the different forums and subreddits and whatnot. That helps a lot, and we have really blown up, and it's all because of people like you. So
yeah.
Thank you very much. We'll be back Sunday night for the instant take. And then we'll be back Tuesday for the full coverage podcast, and boomerang back on Friday with the spoiler edition. Talk to you then.